The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 1, continued. Cassette 6, Side 1.
They sent those who failed to the battle for Stalingrad. And they trained us like young beasts so as to infuriate us to the point where we would later want to take it out on someone else. We never got enough sleep because after taps, as punishment, we might be forced to go through the drill alone under the eyes of a sergeant, or the entire squad might be routed out at night and made to form up because of one uncleaned boot. There he is, the bastard, and he'll keep on cleaning it, and until he gets a shine on it, you're all going to stay standing there. In passionate anticipation of those insignia, we developed a tiger-like stride and a metallic voice of command. Then the officers' stars were fastened on our tabs, and only 1 month later, forming up my battery in the rear, I ordered a careless soldier named Berbenyev to march up and down after taps under the eyes of my insubordinate Sergeant Metlin. And do you know, I'd forgotten all about it until now. I honestly forgot about it for years. Only now, seated in front of this sheet of paper, have I remembered. Some elderly colonel, who was an inspector, happened to be there, and he called me in and put me to shame. And I, and this after I'd left the university, tried to justify my action on the grounds that it was what we had been taught in school. In other words, I meant, what humane views can there be, given the fact that we are in the army? And the more so in the organs. Pride grows in the human heart, like lard on a pig. I tossed out orders to my subordinates that I would not allow them to question, convinced that no orders could be wiser. Even at the front, where one might have thought death made equals of us all, my power soon convinced me that I was a superior human being. Seated there, I heard them out as they stood at attention. I interrupted them, I issued commands, I addressed fathers and grandfathers with the familiar downgrading form of address, while they, of course, addressed me formally. I sent them out to repair wires under shellfire, so that my superiors should not reproach me. Andreyashin died that way. I ate my officer's ration of butter with rolls, without giving a thought as to why I had a right to it, and why the rank-and-file soldiers did not. I, of course, had a personal servant assigned to me, in polite terms, an orderly, whom I badgered one way or another, and ordered to look after my person and prepare my meals separately from the soldiers. After all, the Lubyanka interrogators don't have orderlies. That's one thing you can't say about them. I forced my soldiers to put their backs into it and dig me a special dugout at every new bivouac, and to haul the heaviest beams to support it, so that I should be as comfortable and safe as possible. And wait a minute, yes, my battery always had a guardhouse, too. What kind of guardhouse could there be in the woods? It was a pit, of course, although a better one than those at the Gorokhovets division camps, which I have described, because it had a roof, and the man confined got a soldier's ration. Vyushkov was imprisoned there for losing his horse, and Popkov for maltreating his carbine. Yes, just a moment, I can remember more. They sewed me a map case out of German hide, not human, but from a car seat. But I didn't have a strap for it, and I was unhappy about that. Then all of a sudden they saw some partisan commissar from the local district party committee wearing just the right kind of strap, and they took it away from him. We are the army. We have seniority. Remember Senchenko, the security officer who stole a map case and a dispatch case? Finally, I coveted that scarlet box, and I remember how they took it away and got it for me. That's what shoulder boards do to a human being. And where have all the exhortations of grandmother, standing before an icon, gone? And where the young pioneer's daydreams of future sacred equality? And at the moment, when my life was turned upside down, and the smirch officers at the brigade command point tore off those cursed shoulder boards and took my belt away and shoved me along to their automobile, I was pierced to the quick by worrying how, in my stripped and sorry state, I was going to make my way through the telephone operator's room. The rank and file must not see me in that condition. The day after my arrest, my march of penance began. The most recent catch was always sent from the Army Counterintelligence Center to the counterintelligence headquarters of the front. They herded us on foot from Osteroda to Brodnica. When they led me out of the punishment cell, there were already 7 prisoners there, in 3.5 pairs, standing with their backs to me. 6 of them had on well-worn Russian army overcoats, which had been around for a long time, and on their backs had been painted, in indelible white paint, SU, meaning Soviet Union. I already knew that mark, having seen it more than once on the backs of our Russian POWs, as they wandered sadly and guiltily toward the army that was approaching to free them. They had been freed, but there was no shared happiness in that liberation. Their compatriots glowered at them even more grimly than at the Germans. And as soon as they crossed the front lines, they were arrested and imprisoned. The 7th prisoner was a German civilian in a black 3-piece suit, a black overcoat, and black hat. He was over 50, tall, well-groomed, and his white face had been nurtured on gentleman's food. I completed the 4th pair, and the Tatar sergeant, chief of the convoy, gestured to me to pick up my sealed suitcase, which stood off to one side. It contained my officer's equipment, as well as all the papers which had been seized as evidence when I was arrested. What did he mean, carry my suitcase? He, a sergeant, wanted me, an officer, to pick up my suitcase and carry it? A large, heavy object, despite the new regulations, while beside me 6 men from the ranks would be marching empty-handed, and 1 representative of a conquered nation. I did not express this whole complex set of ideas to the sergeant. I merely said, "I am an officer. Let the German carry it." None of the prisoners turned around at my words. Turning around was forbidden. Only my mate in the 4th pair, also an SU, looked at me in astonishment. When he had been captured, our army wasn't yet like that. But the sergeant from counterintelligence was not surprised, even though I was not, of course, an officer in his eyes. Still, his indoctrination and mine coincided. He summoned the innocent German and ordered him to carry the suitcase. It was just as well the latter had not understood our conversation. The rest of us put our hands behind our backs. The former POWs did not have even 1 bag among them. They had left the motherland with empty hands, and that is exactly how they returned to her. So our column marched off, 4 pairs in file. We did not converse with our convoy, and it was absolutely forbidden to talk among ourselves, whether on the march, during a halt, or at overnight stops. As accused prisoners, we were required to move as though separated by invisible partitions, as though suffocated, each in his own solitary confinement cell. The early spring weather was changeable. At times, a thin mist hung in the air, and even on the firm highway, the liquid mud squelched dismally beneath our boots. At times, the heavens cleared, and the soft yellow sun, still uncertain of its talent, warmed the already thawing hillocks and showed us, with perfect clarity, the world we were about to leave. At times, a hostile squall flew to the attack, and tore from the black clouds a snow that was not really even white, which beat icily on faces and backs and feet, soaking through our overcoats and our footcloths. 6 backs ahead of me, 6 constant backs. There was more than enough time to examine and re-examine the crooked, hideous brands SU and the shiny black cloth on the German's back. There was more than enough time to reconsider my former life and to comprehend my present one. But I couldn't. I had been smashed on the head with an oak club, but I still didn't comprehend. 6 backs. There was neither approval nor condemnation in their swing. The German, soon tired, he shifted the suitcase from hand to hand, grabbed at his heart, made signs to the convoy that he couldn't carry it any further. At that point, his neighbor in the pair, a POW who only a little while before had experienced God knows what in German captivity, but perhaps mercy too, took the suitcase of his own free will and carried it. After that, the other POWs carried it in turn, also without being ordered to, and then the German again. All but me, and no one said a word to me. At one point we met a long string of empty carts. The drivers studied us with interest, and some of them jumped up to full height on top of the carts and stared. I understood very quickly that their stares and their malice were directed toward me. I was very sharply set off from the others. My coat was new, long, and cut to fit my figure snugly. My tabs had not yet been torn off, and in the filtered sunlight my buttons, also not cut off, burned with the glitter of cheap gold. It was easy to see I was an officer, with a look of newness, too, and newly taken into custody. Perhaps this very fall from the heights stimulated them, and gave them pleasure, suggesting some gleam of justice, but more likely they could not get it into their heads, stuffed with political indoctrination, that one of their own company commanders could be arrested in this way, and they all decided unanimously I had come from the other side. Aha! The Vlasov bastard got caught, did he? Shoot the rat! They were vehement in their rear line wrath. The most intense patriotism always flourishes in the rear, and they added a good deal more in mother oaths. They regarded me as some kind of international operator who had nonetheless been caught, and as a result the advance at the front would move along faster, and the war would come to an end sooner. How was I to answer them? I was forbidden to utter a single word, and I would have had to explain my entire life to each and every one of them. What could I do to make them understand that I was not a spy, a saboteur, that I was their friend, that it was because of them that I was here? I smiled. Looking up at them, I smiled at them from a column of prisoners under escort. But my bared teeth seemed to them the worst kind of mockery, and they shook their fists and bellowed insults at me even more violently than before. I smiled in pride that I had been arrested not for stealing, nor treason, nor desertion, but because I had discovered, through my power of reasoning, the evil secrets of Stalin. I smiled at the thought that I wanted, and might still be able, to effect some small remedies and changes in our Russian way of life. But all that time my suitcase was being carried by others, and I didn't even feel remorseful about it. And if my neighbour, whose sunken cheeks were already covered with a soft 2-week growth of beard, and whose eyes were filled to overflowing with suffering and knowledge, had then and there reproached me in the clearest of clear Russian words for having disgraced the honour of a prisoner by appealing to the convoy for help, and had accused me of haughtiness, of setting myself up above the rest of them, I would not have understood him. I simply would not have understood what he was talking about. I was an officer. And if 7 of us had to die on the way, and the 8th could have been saved by the convoy, what was to keep me from crying out, "Sergeant, save me! I am an officer!" And that's what an officer is, even when his shoulder boards aren't blue. And if they are blue, if he has been indoctrinated to believe that even among other officers he is the salt of the earth, and that he knows more than others, and is entrusted with more responsibility than others, and that, consequently, it is his duty to force a prisoner's head between his legs, and then to shove him like that into a pipe. Why shouldn't he? I credited myself with unselfish dedication, but meanwhile I had been thoroughly prepared to be an executioner. And if I had gotten into an NKVD school under Yezhov, maybe I would have matured just in time for Beria. So let the reader who expects this book to be a political exposé slam its covers shut right now. If only it were all so simple, if only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being, and who is willing to destroy a piece of his own heart? During the life of any heart, this line keeps changing place. Sometimes it is squeezed one way by exuberant evil, and sometimes it shifts to allow enough space for good to flourish. One and the same human being is, at various ages, under various circumstances, a totally different human being. At times he is close to being a devil, at times to sainthood. But his name doesn't change, and to that name we ascribe the whole lot, good and evil. Socrates taught us, "Know thyself." Confronted by the pit into which we are about to toss those who have done us harm, we halt, stricken dumb, It is, after all, only because of the way things worked out that they were the executioners and we weren't. If Malyutia Skuratov had summoned us, we too probably would have done our work well. From good to evil is one quaver, says the proverb, and correspondingly from evil to good. From the moment when our society was convulsed by the reminder of those illegalities and tortures, they began on all sides to explain, to write, to protest. Good people were there too, meaning in the NKVD MGB. We know which good people they're talking about. They were the ones who whispered to the old Bolsheviks, "Don't weaken," or even sneaked a sandwich into them, and who kicked all the rest around wherever they found them. But weren't there also some who rose above the party, who were good in a general human sense? Broadly speaking, they should not have been there. The organs avoided employing such people, eliminating them at the recruitment stage. And such people played their hand shrewdly so as to get out of it. During the war, a certain Leningrad aviator, after being discharged from the hospital in Ryazan, went to a TB clinic and begged, "Please find something wrong with me. I'm under orders to go into the organs." The radiologists dreamed up a touch of TB for him, and the organs dropped him post-haste. Whoever got in by mistake either adjusted to the milieu, or else was thrown out, or eased out, or even fell across the rails himself. Still, were there no good people left there? In Kishinev, a young Lieutenant Gaibist went to Father Viktor Shipovalnikov a full month before he was arrested. "Get away from here! Go away! They plan to arrest you!" Did he do this on his own, or did his mother send him to warn the priest? After the arrest, this young man was assigned to Father Viktor as an escort guard, and he grieved for him. "Why didn't you go away?" Or here's another. I had a platoon commander named Lieutenant Ovzianikov. At the front, no one was closer to me than he was. During half the war, we ate from the same pot. Even under enemy shell fire, we would gulp down our food between explosions so the stew wouldn't get cold. He was a peasant lad with a clean soul and a view of life so undistorted that neither officer candidate school nor being an officer had spoiled him in any degree. He even did what he could to soften my hard edges in many ways. Throughout his service as an officer, he concentrated on one thing only, preserving the lives and strength of his soldiers, many of whom were no longer young. He was the first to tell me what the Russian villages were like then and what the collective farms were like. He talked about all this without resentment, without protest, very simply and straightforwardly, just as a forest pool reflects the image of a tree and all its branches, even the smallest. He was deeply shocked by my arrest. He wrote me a combat reference containing the highest praise and got the divisional commander to sign it. After he was demobilized, he continued to try to help me, through my relatives, and this, mind you, was in 1947, which was not very different from 1937. At my interrogation, I had many reasons to be afraid on his account, especially lest they read my war diary, which contained the stories he'd told me. When I was rehabilitated in 1957, I very much wanted to find him. I remembered his village address and wrote once and then again, but there was no reply. I discovered one thread I could follow, that he had graduated from the Yaroslavl Pedagogical Institute. When I inquired there, they replied, "He was sent to work in the organs of state security." Fine, all the more interesting. I wrote to him at his city address, but there was no reply. Several years passed, and Ivan Denisovich was published. Well, I thought, now he'll turn up. No. 3 years later, I asked one of my Yaroslavl correspondents to go to him and personally hand him a letter. My correspondent did as I asked and wrote me, "Evidently, he has never read Ivan Denisovich." And truly, why should they know how things go with prisoners after they've been sentenced? This time, Ovzianikov couldn't keep silent any longer. He wrote, "After the institute, they offered me work in the organs, and it seemed to me I would be just as successful there." What did he mean, successful? I cannot say that I have prospered remarkably in my new walk of life. There are some things I did not like, but I work hard, and, if I am not mistaken, I shall not let my comrades down. And that's the justification, comradeship. He ended, I no longer think about the future. And that is all. Allegedly, he had not received my previous letters. Evidently, he doesn't want to see me. But if we had met, I think this would have been a better chapter. In Stalin's last years, he had already become an interrogator, during those very years when they handed out a 25-year sentence to everyone who came along. How did everything in his consciousness recircuit itself? How did everything black out? But remembering the once selfless, dedicated boy, as fresh as spring water, can I possibly believe that everything in him changed beyond recall? That there are no living tendrils left? When the interrogator Goldman gave Vera Korneyeva the 206 form on non-disclosure to sign, she began to catch on to her rights, and then she began to go into the case in detail, involving as it did all 17 members of their religious group. Goldman raged, but he had to let her study the file. In order not to be bored waiting for her, he led her to a large office where half a dozen employees were sitting, and left her there. At first she read quietly, but then a conversation began, perhaps because the others were bored, and Vera launched aloud into a real religious sermon. One would have had to know her to appreciate this to the full. She was a luminous person, with a lively mind and a gift of eloquence, even though in freedom she had been no more than a lathe operator, a stable girl, and a housewife. They listened to her impressively, now and then asking questions in order to clarify something or other. It was catching them from an unexpected side of things. People came in from other offices, and the room filled up. Even though they were only typists, stenographers, file clerks, and not interrogators, in 1946 this was still their milieu, the organs. It is impossible to reconstruct her monologue. She managed to work in all sorts of things, including the question of traitors of the motherland. Why were there no traitors in the 1812 war of the fatherland when there was still serfdom? It would have been natural to have traitors then. But mostly she spoke about religious faith and religious believers. Formerly, she declared, unbridled passions were the basis for everything. Steal the stolen goods. And in that state of affairs, religious believers were naturally a hindrance to you. But now, when you want to build and prosper in this world, why do you persecute your best citizens? They represent your most precious material. After all, believers don't need to be watched. They do not steal, and they do not shirk. Do you think you can build a just society on a foundation of self-serving and envious people? Everything in the country is falling apart. Why do you spit in the hearts of your best people? Separate church and state properly, and do not touch the church. You will not lose a thing thereby. Are you materialists? In that case, put your faith in education, in the possibility that it will, as they say, disperse religious faith. But why arrest people? At this point, Goldman came in and started to interrupt rudely, but everyone shouted at him, Oh, shut up! Keep quiet! Go ahead, woman, talk! And how should they have addressed her? Citizeness? Comrade? Those forms of address were forbidden, and these people were bound by the conventions of Soviet life. But woman, that was how Christ had spoken, and you couldn't go wrong there. And Vera continued in the presence of her interrogator. So there, in the MGB office, those people listened to Korneyeva, and why did the words of an insignificant prisoner touch them so near the quick? That same D. Terekov, I mentioned earlier, remembers to this day the first prisoner he sentenced to death. I was sorry for him. His memory obviously clings to something that came from his heart. But after that first one, he forgot many and no longer kept count anymore. An episode with Terekov. Attempting to prove to me the fairness of the judicial system under Khrushchev, he energetically struck the plate glass desk top with his hand and cut his wrist on the edge. He rang for help. His subordinates were at the ready. The senior officer on duty brought him iodine and hydrogen peroxide. Continuing the conversation, he helplessly held dampened cotton to the wound. It appears that his blood coagulates poorly. And thus God showed him clearly the limitations of a human being, and he had delivered verdicts, imposed death sentences on others. No matter how icy the jailers in the big house in Leningrad, the innermost nucleus of the heart, for a nucleus has its own nucleus, had to continue to exist, did it not? N.P. blank V.A. recalls the time when she was being taken to interrogation by an impassive, silent woman guard with unseeing eyes, when suddenly the bombs began to explode right next to the big house, and it sounded as if at the next moment they would fall directly on them. The terrified guard threw her arms around her prisoner and embraced her, desperate for human companionship and sympathy. Then the bombing stopped, and her eyes became unseeing again. "Hands behind your back! Move along!" Well, of course, there was no great merit in that, to become a human being at the moment of death. Similarly, loving one's own children is no proof of virtue. People often try to excuse scoundrels by saying, "He's a good family man." The chairman of the Supreme Court, I.T. Golyakov, is praised. He enjoyed digging in his garden. He loved books. He used to browse around used and rare bookstores. He knew the work of Tolstoy, Korolenko, and Chekhov. Well, what did he learn from them? How many thousands did he destroy? Or, for example, that colonel, Concordia Yossa's friend, who had roared with laughter in the Vladimir detention prison at the memory of locking up a group of old Jews in an ice-filled root cellar, had been afraid of one thing only during all his debaucheries, that his wife might find out about them. She believed in him, regarded him as noble, and this faith of hers was precious to him. But do we dare accept that feeling as a bridgehead to virtue in his heart? And why is it that for nearly 200 years the security forces have hung on to the color of the heavens? That was what they wore in Lermontov's lifetime. And you, blue uniforms. Then came blue service caps, blue shoulder boards, blue tabs, and then they were ordered to make themselves less conspicuous, and the blue brims were hidden from the gratitude of the people, and everything blue on heads and shoulders was made narrower, until what was left was piping, narrow rims, but still blue. Is this only a masquerade? Or is it that even blackness must, every so often, however rarely, partake of the heavens? It would be beautiful to think so, but when one learns, for example, the nature of the Yagoda's striving towards the sacred, an eyewitness from the group around Gorky, who was close to Yagoda at the time, reports that in the vestibule of the bathhouse on Yagoda's estate near Moscow, icons were placed so that Yagoda and his comrades, after undressing, could use them as targets for revolver practice before going in to take their baths. Just how are we to understand that? As the act of an evildoer? What sort of behavior is it? Do such people really exist? We would prefer to say that such people cannot exist, that there aren't any. It is permissible to portray evildoers in a story for children so as to keep the picture simple. But when the great world literature of the past, Shakespeare, Schiller, Dickens, inflates images of evildoers of the blackest shades, it seems somewhat farcical and clumsy to our contemporary perception. The trouble lies in the way these classic evildoers are pictured. They recognize themselves as evildoers, and they know their souls are black. And they reason, "I cannot live unless I do evil, so I'll set my father against my brother. I'll drink the victim's sufferings until I'm drunk with them." Iago very precisely identifies his purposes and his motives as being black and born of hate. But no, that's not the way it is. To do evil, a human being must first of all believe that what he's doing is good, or else that it's a well-considered act in conformity with natural law. Fortunately, it isn't the nature of the human being to seek a justification for his actions. Macbeth's self-justifications were feeble, and his conscience devoured him. Yes, even Iago was a little lamb, too. The imagination and the spiritual strength of Shakespeare's evildoers stopped short at a dozen corpses, because they had no ideology. Ideology, that is what gives evildoing its long-sought justification, and gives the evildoer the necessary steadfastness and determination. That is the social theory which helps to make his acts seem good instead of bad in his own and others' eyes, so that he won't hear reproaches and curses, but will receive praise and honors. That was how the agents of the Inquisition fortified their wills, by invoking Christianity. the conquerors of foreign lands by extolling the grandeur of their motherland, the colonizers by civilization, the Nazis by race, and the Jacobins, early and late, by equality, brotherhood, and the happiness of future generations. Thanks to ideology, the 20th century was fated to experience evil-doing on a scale calculated in the millions. This cannot be denied, nor passed over, nor suppressed. How, then, do we dare insist that evil-doers do not exist? And who was it that destroyed these millions? Without evil-doers, there would have been no archipelago. There was a rumor going the rounds between 1918 and 1920 that the Petrograd Cheka, headed by Yuritsky, and the Odessa Cheka, headed by Deich, did not shoot all those condemned to death, but fed some of them alive to the animals in the city zoos. I do not know whether this is truth or calumny, or if there were any such cases, how many there were, but I wouldn't set out to look for proof either. Following the practice of the Blue Caps, I would propose that they prove to us that this was impossible. How else could they get food for the zoos in those famine years? Take it away from the working class? Those enemies were going to die anyway, so why couldn't their deaths support the zoo economy of the Republic and thereby assist our march into the future? Wasn't it expedient? That is the precise line the Shakespearean evildoer could not cross, but the evildoer with ideology does cross it, and his eyes remain dry and clear. Physics is aware of phenomena which occur only at threshold magnitudes, which do not exist at all until a certain threshold encoded by and known to nature has been crossed. No matter how intense a yellow light you shine on a lithium sample, it will not emit electrons. But as soon as a weak bluish light begins to glow, it does emit them. The threshold of the photoelectric effect has been crossed. You can cool oxygen to 100 degrees below zero centigrade and exert as much pressure as you want. It does not yield, but remains a gas. But as soon as minus 183 degrees is reached, it liquefies and begins to flow. Evidently, evil doing also has a threshold magnitude. Yes, a human being hesitates and bobs back and forth between good and evil all his life. He slips, falls back, clambers up, repents, things begin to darken again. But just so long as the threshold of evil-doing is not crossed, the possibility of returning remains, and he himself is still within reach of our hope. But when, through the density of evil actions, the result either of their own extreme degree or of the absoluteness of his power, he suddenly crosses that threshold, he has left humanity behind and without, perhaps, the possibility of return. From the most ancient times, justice has been a two-part concept. Virtue triumphs, and vice is punished. We have been fortunate enough to live to a time when virtue, though it does not triumph, is nonetheless not always tormented by attack dogs. Beaten down, sickly, virtue has now been allowed to enter in all its tatters and sit in the corner, as long as it doesn't raise its voice. However, no one dares say a word about vice. Yes, they did mock virtue, but there was no vice in that. Yes, so and so many millions did get mowed down, but no one was to blame for it. And if someone pipes up, "What about those who..." The answer comes from all sides, reproachfully and amicably at first. "What are you talking about, comrade? Why open old wounds?" Even in connection with one day in the life of Ivan Denisovich, the retired Blue Caps living on pensions objected, because the book might reopen the wounds of those who had been imprisoned in camp. Allegedly, they were the ones to be protected. Then they go after you with an oaken club. "Shut up! Haven't you had enough yet? You think you've been rehabilitated?" In that same period, by 1966, 86,000 Nazi criminals had been convicted in West Germany. Meanwhile, in East Germany, nothing of the sort is to be heard, which means that there they have been shod with new shoes. They are valued in the service of the state. And still, we choke with anger here. We do not hesitate to devote to the subject page after newspaper page, and hour after hour of radio time. We even stay after work to attend protest meetings and vote, "Too few! 86,000 are too few!" and 20 years is too little. It must go on and on. And during the same period, in our own country, according to the reports of the Military Collegium of the Supreme Court, about 10 men have been convicted. What takes place beyond the Oder and the Rhine gets us all worked up. What goes on in the environs of Moscow and behind the green fences near Sochi, or the fact that the murderers of our husbands and fathers ride through our streets and we make way for them as they pass, doesn't get us worked up at all, doesn't touch us. That would be digging up the past. Meanwhile, if we translate 86,000 West Germans into our own terms, on the basis of comparative population figures, it would become 250,000. But in a quarter century, we have not tracked down anyone. We have not brought anyone to trial. It is their wounds we are afraid to reopen. And as a symbol of them all, the smug and stupid Molotov lives on at Granovsky No. 3, a man who has learned nothing at all, even now, though he is saturated with our blood and nobly crosses the sidewalk to seat himself in his long, wide automobile. Here is a riddle not for us contemporaries to figure out. Why is Germany allowed to punish its evildoers and Russia is not? What kind of disastrous path lies ahead of us if we do not have the chance to purge ourselves of that putrefaction rotting inside our body? What, then, can Russia teach the world? In the German trials, an astonishing phenomenon takes place from time to time. The defendant clasps his head in his hands, refuses to make any defense, and from then on asks no concessions from the court. He says that the presentation of his crimes, revived and once again confronting him, has filled him with revulsion, and he no longer wants to live. That is the ultimate height a trial can attain, when evil is so utterly condemned that even the criminal is revolted by it. A country which has condemned evil 86,000 times from the rostrum of a court, and irrevocably condemned it in literature and among its young people year by year, step by step, is purged of it. What are we to do? Some day our descendants will describe our several generations as generations of driveling do-nothings. First we submissively allowed them to massacre us by the millions, and then with devoted concern we tended the murderers in their prosperous old age. What are we to do if the great Russian tradition of penitence is incomprehensible and absurd to them? What are we to do if the animal terror of hearing even 100th part of all they subjected others to outweighs in their hearts any inclination to justice? If they cling greedily to the harvest of benefits they have watered with the blood of those who perished? It is clear enough that those men who turned the handle of the meat grinder, even as late as 1937, are no longer young. They are 50 to 80 years old. They have lived the best years of their lives, prosperously, well-nourished and comfortable, so that it is too late for any kind of equal retribution as far as they are concerned. But let us be generous. We will not shoot them. We will not pour salt water into them, nor bury them in bedbugs, nor bridle them into a swan dive, nor keep them on sleepless stand-up for a week, nor kick them with jackboots, nor beat them with rubber truncheons, nor squeeze their skulls in iron rings, nor push them into a cell so that they lie atop one another like pieces of baggage. We will not do any of the things they did, but for the sake of our country and our children, we have the duty to seek them all out and bring them all to trial, not to put them on trial so much as their crimes, and to compel each one of them to announce loudly, "Yes, I was an executioner and a murderer." And if these words were spoken in our country only 250,000 times, a just proportion if we are not to fall behind West Germany, would it perhaps be enough? It is unthinkable in the 20th century to fail to distinguish between what constitutes an abominable atrocity that must be prosecuted and what constitutes that past which ought not to be stirred up. We have to condemn publicly the very idea that some people have the right to repress others. In keeping silent about evil, in burying it so deep within us that no sign of it appears on the surface, we are implanting it, and it will rise up a thousandfold in the future. When we neither punish nor reproach evildoers, we are not simply protecting their trivial old age. We are thereby ripping the foundations of justice from beneath new generations. It is for this reason, and not because of the weakness of indoctrinational work, that they are growing up indifferent. Young people are acquiring the conviction that foul deeds are never punished on earth, but they always bring prosperity. It is going to be uncomfortable, horrible, to live in such a country. Chapter 5. First Cell, First Love. How is one to take the title of this chapter, A Cell and Love, in the same breath? Ah, well, probably it has to do with Leningrad during the blockade, and you were imprisoned in the big house. In that case, it would be very understandable. That's why you were still alive, because they shoved you in there. It was the best place in Leningrad, not only for the interrogators who even lived there and had offices in the cellars in case of shelling. Joking aside, in Leningrad in those days no one washed and everyone's face was covered with a black crust. But in the big house, prisoners were given a hot shower every 10th day. Well, it's true that only the corridors were heated for the jailers. The cells were left unheated, but after all there were water pipes in the cells that worked and a toilet, and where else in Leningrad could you find that? And the bread ration was just like the ration outside, barely 4.5 ounces. In addition, there was broth made from slaughtered horses once a day, and thin gruel once a day as well. It was a case of the cats being envious of the dog's life. But what about punishment cells? And what about the supreme measure, execution? No, that isn't what the chapter title is about. Not at all. You sit down and half close your eyes and try to remember them all. How many different cells you were imprisoned in during your term. It is difficult even to count them. And in each one there were people. People. There might be 2 people in one, 150 in another. You were imprisoned for 5 minutes in one, and all summer long in another. But in every case, out of all the cells you've been in, your first cell is a very special one, the place where you first encountered others like yourself, doomed to the same fate. All your life you will remember it with an emotion that you otherwise experience only in remembering your first love, and those people who shared with you the floor and air of that stone cubicle during those days when you rethought your entire life, will from time to time be recollected by you as members of your own family. Yes, in those days, they were your only family. What you experience in your first interrogation cell parallels nothing in your entire previous life or your whole subsequent life. No doubt prisons have stood for thousands of years before you came along, and may continue to stand after you, too, longer than one would like to think. But that first interrogation cell is unique and inimitable. Maybe it was a terrible place for a human being, a lice-laden, bed-bug-infested lock-up, without windows, without ventilation, without bunks, and with a dirty floor, a box called a KPZ. KPZ equals cell for preliminary detention. DPZ equals house of preliminary detention. In other words, where interrogations are conducted, not where sentences are served. In the village Soviet, at the police station, in the railroad station, or in some port. The KPZs and the DPZs are scattered across the face of our land in the greatest abundance. There are masses of prisoners in them. Or maybe it was solitary in the Archangel prison, where the glass had been smeared over with red lead so that the only rays of God's maimed light which crept into you were crimson, and where a 15-watt bulb burned constantly in the ceiling day and night. Or solitary in the city of Choibalsan, where, for 6 months at a time, 14 of you were crowded onto 7 square yards of floor space, in such a way that you could only shift your bent legs in unison. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.